Good morning. It's great to be with you this morning. It's something I've looked forward to all week, this opportunity to come this morning and talk about divorce. Maybe not. We're going through the Sermon on the Mount, and last week we came to lust. So, you got to preach it. So then this week we're coming to divorce, and you got to preach it. It's in there, and so I'll ask your patience this morning, because I have a whole lot to say, and I can't say half of what I'd like to say. So I want to say a few words at the outset, because this is a tender subject. Some of you here this morning are concerned about the state of marriage in our society. You're thinking, man, I sure hope this message really hits the value of commitments and keeping that promise. And I do too. And some of you are struggling in a marriage and you're not sure what you want to hear right now. Some of your parents went through a divorce when you were a child and you still feel that sadness. Some of you have been through the pain of a divorce personally, and maybe even have been to a church where you heard a message that divorce is the unforgivable sin, basically, and made you feel like you're damaged goods. The church has a history of shooting its wounded. I want you to know that my hope is that this message will offer a bit of hope and healing. I've never known anyone who walked down the aisle thinking, I plan on this ending in divorce. I've conducted some weddings in which they didn't make it. But I knew before we went in, when we did the wedding, that they fully intended to keep that promise that they were about to make each other. And so some of you are thinking, this is kind of a controversial subject. Is it okay that we talk about this? And the answer to that is, of course. Jesus addressed it in the Sermon on the Mount, the greatest sermon that's ever been preached. And anything Jesus talked about, we can talk about. And he'll help us as we do it. I warn you that this will involve, like I say, walking through a lot of information. Some of this will probably be new to you. I'd be surprised if it's not new to you. Some of it's relatively new to me, too. I had no questions about this topic when I finished my first Bible degree and got my first full-time preaching job. I knew exactly what I believed, and I thought I knew exactly what the Bible taught. But the real problems of real people in the church kept sending me back to the Bible with unexpected questions, and I kept finding unexpected answers. And I'm still learning even today. To interpret correctly, it's necessary to read the Bible, or really any book, in its context. And so that's what we're going to try to do before we get to Matthew 5 this morning. We're going to try to establish the context in which those words were said. Way back in the ancient world, before Jesus and even before the Old Testament, the ancient Near East was pretty much governed by the Hammurabi Code. Some of you have heard about that code when you were in high school. If you were a wife under the Hammurabi Code, your husband could divorce you at any time and for any reason just by walking out of the house. You would be stuck with the kids if there were any. You'd have no money. But let's say that you had sons and you found some way to raise them, and that as they got old enough to work on the farm, you began to turn a profit and you began to accumulate some things. Well, at that point, your ex-husband could return at any time and reclaim you and the kids and the money and the farm. What that meant was, if you were a wife and your husband left, even though technically you could remarry, the reality was no man would ever marry you if husband number one were lurking around out there somewhere and could come back and take you and your property. So if you were a woman in that world and your marriage broke up, you were in a difficult strait. In that day, divorce involved a lot of contention around money and finances. Fortunately, in our day, people are more mature going through a divorce. Now, that's, by the way, maybe all the humor you get in this sermon. Sorry. A lot of it revolved around issues of finances and possessions. Women were very vulnerable in the ancient world. To a large degree, they were just considered the property of their husbands. And though they were cherished They were considered highly valuable. Often they were cherished. They had no more and sometimes less legal rights than a slave. So, of course, they had no right to initiate a divorce. Only their owner, their husband, could do that. One of the striking aspects of the law of Moses compared to the laws of the ancient Near East was its concern for women. God always operates with love and compassion toward his children and especially toward those who are powerless. And it was clear from Genesis that God's intent for marriage was that it be a permanent commitment from a husband as well as his wife. If it did break up, Moses said, Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, if a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her, and sends her from his house, which is obviously the first part of a long sentence. Now, the certificate that he gives her when he finds something that displeases him, something bad, something indecent about her, the certificate was a way of protecting the woman because it meant that the first husband could never come back and reclaim her if she ever married another man. It was basically a statement that said, you were no longer obligated under this marriage. You were free of this marriage. And it actually stated explicitly, Deuteronomy 24 does, in verse 4, and it says that for her first husband to remarry her after she's been married to another man, whether that man divorces her or that man dies, for the first husband to ever remarry her would be detestable to God and would bring sin upon the land. That's obviously, I think, in response to the Hammurabi Code that left women so vulnerable. Deuteronomy 24 was protecting women so that that man couldn't come back and reclaim her at any time in her later life after they've been divorced. But that also is the exact opposite of what I was taught growing up. What I was taught was that if the woman remarried, that second marriage wasn't recognized by God, that she was actually living in adultery instead of married to her second husband, that her first husband was still her actual husband, and her only choice was to go back to him or remain single for the rest of her life. So the church I grew up in taught that God today wants us to do something he used to consider detestable. So just to throw in for free, let me say this. A failure to read and understand the Old Testament leads to a failure to understand the New Testament. But in the church of my youth, we had little regard for the Old Testament. We didn't know it very well. We didn't study it very closely because we knew that it's Jesus who saves us and he's in the New Testament. We were right about that. But somehow we forgot that knowledge of the Old Testament was the starting point for Jesus, the apostles, and the early church. We often quoted 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17. All scripture is God-breathed and is useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness so that the servant of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work. We love that passage because we understood the value of God's inspired word. But when that passage says all scripture is God-breathed, it's primarily referring to the Old Testament, which was the only scripture the church had when Paul wrote those words. The New Testament was still in the very early stages of being written. The 27 books of the New Testament had not been collected. They certainly had not been distributed. So when he says that the scriptures are profitable for reproof and correction and training in righteousness and teaching, he's talking about the Old Testament. To the church. So context. Going back to Deuteronomy 24, it mentions divorce on the grounds of indecency. A man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her. And that was a loaded term. The Hebrew word translated indecent was nakedness, which was a euphemism for sexual immorality. And it's used that way in many passages throughout the Old Testament when you come across that term, nakedness. It's kind of like we would say a couple slept together, but we all know They were doing more than sleeping. We knew what that meant. So he discovers that his wife has been sexually intimate with another man, and it displeases him so much that he gives her a certificate to prove that she's no longer his property and sends her away. And this raises the question, what about other cases? Were there provision for divorce because of abuse or abandonment? Well, kind of, in a roundabout way. Exodus chapter 21. We find another classic text on divorce. The law here is dealing with the question, what happens if a man takes a second wife? Dealing with polygamy. Now, polygamy was practiced in the ancient world, and many of the patriarchs involved in it, were engaged in it, and many of the early kings, they were all polygamous. That wasn't because God approved of it. It was never God's intention. He made that clear in Genesis 2. But it was practiced. And so when it was practiced, the Mosaic law included a provision to protect the interest, the life of the first wife. Because as always, God is loving and merciful toward real people in real circumstances, especially if they're victims. And so Exodus 21, verse 10 and 11 says, if he marries another woman, he must not deprive the first one of her food, clothing, and marital rights, conjugal rights. If he does not provide her with these three things, she is to go free without any payment of money. Once again, the law is seeking to protect the woman. In this case, the husband takes a new wife into the home, and human nature being what it is, the new wife tends to get the good stuff. So the law said, when he, the husband, married his first wife, he made a vow to provide support, food and clothing, and love. So if he breaks that vow, then the first wife is free to leave and remarry without having to pay the husband back for his investment in her. He paid her dad for her. She doesn't have to pay him back because he's not living up to his vow to provide for her and to love her. Now, over time, the rabbis looked at these two passages, Deuteronomy 24 and Exodus 11, became the classic text on the scriptures governing divorce. And they said, here's the principle that's involved. Based on these texts, marriage involves a vow, and these vows include three primary promises. Fidelity, to be faithful, no sexual unfaithfulness, to provide food and clothing, and so on, and sexual intimacy and affection. Marriage is a vow to be faithful, to provide, and to love. And when these vows are broken, the victim of the broken vows has a right to get divorced. Male or female, that would include the right to be remarried. Now, there was no such thing in Judaism as a divorce that did not include the right to remarry. That was the idea behind the certificate. Now, understand, the women did not have the right to get a divorce, and that in most cases, women were dependents. Young women had no way to support themselves other than by dependency on a man, maybe her family, if her parents are still alive, maybe by begging or by prostitution. So there was no thought of refusing to allow a divorced woman to get remarried. In many cases, that would have forced her into extreme poverty and possible starvation. And so that was never a consideration. There was always, remarriage was always a given in all of these texts. Rabbis would debate what constituted the breaking of these vows because they took them very seriously. How much food was included in the promise to provide? That's the kind of question they would work on. They were legalists. What about clothing? How about conjugal love? And this is the kind of thing that rabbis did. They came up with rules around the idea of physical intimacy. For example, according to their rules, the husband had to offer to be physically intimate with his wife at least twice a week, or she had the right to divorce him if he didn't do it. They made exceptions in some cases. For instance, if he was a donkey driver, he only had to offer it one time a week. I guess that's like being a trucker out on the road. If he was unemployed, a husband had to at least if he was unemployed, husband had to at least make the offer of physical intimacy every night, 7 nights a week, or his wife could divorce him. Not making that up. That's what they said. I guess that rabbis were pretty much all unemployed. did rabbis believe that biblical grounds for divorce would include things like abandonment or abuse? Well, of course they did. Abandonment would be one of the most egregious forms of breaking the vow to provide or to love. Abuse would be an extreme form of breaking the vow to love. In Israel, those would be grounds for divorce. That did not mean that anybody thought God believed divorce was a good idea. It was not. But this is a way of preventing worse injustice and suffering when vows were broken. And that's the framework for marriage and divorce in ancient Israel. In Jesus' day, there were a few new developments. Two of the most famous rabbis who lived a few decades before Jesus and dominated rabbinical teaching were named Hillel and Shammai. They were kind of the big dogs among rabbis, and schools were formed around them and the way they interpreted the law. Hillel looked at the law in Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, where Moses said a man can divorce his wife for a cause of sexual immorality. Hillel reflected on this text and said, now Moses could have said that a man could divorce his wife for sexual immorality, but for some reason he includes this phrase, for the cause of sexual immorality. This is a good legalist. Why does he include that phrase? Hillel reasoned that the word must refer to another cause, another reason the husband could be displeased with his wife, and a different grounds for divorce besides sexual infidelity. Since it was just the word cause, Hillel concluded that it must mean any cause. In other words, Hillel said that Deuteronomy 24 meant that a man could divorce his wife for one of two reasons, sexual immorality or any cause. Hillel was a man. The rabbis in his school were men. Times had changed, and now under Roman law, women had the legal right to initiate a divorce. But Hillel and his school decided that this any cause divorce would be available to only one gender. Guess which gender they decided on? Men only, for any cause. Again, rabbis would list different faults they believed a husband could divorce his wife for under this any cause provision. They listed things like, if a wife spoiled her husband's dinner, he could divorce her. Or if she walked around with her hair unbound, her husband could divorce her because that was considered improper. Or if she argued in a voice loud enough to be heard in the next house, he could divorce her. One drawback to the any cause divorce was it was, in many cases, more expensive. If the husband could prove that a spouse had committed adultery or abuse in court, then he might be entitled to a refund or partial refund of the bride price that he had paid for her from her family. And in addition to that, he had made a commitment to pay a ketubah, a marriage inheritance. It was promised at the wedding. If he could prove that she was guilty of these things, then he was freed from having to pay the inheritance, and he might be able to claw back, doubtful but possible, some of the bride price he had initially paid for her, especially if they had just been married, if it was brand new, or maybe if they were engaged and not even been married yet. So one drawback to the any-cause divorce was it could be more expensive. If the husband could prove that a spouse had committed adultery, he might get part of the bride price back. Hillel is saying, now there's a new divorce option available. It's never been available before in the history of Israel. It's the any-cause divorce available to any husband. Soon, as you might imagine, it became the most popular form of divorce in Israel. It was an innovation of Hillel. The other important rabbi, Shammai, disagreed. He said, no, Deuteronomy 24, verse 1 refers only to divorce being allowed for sexual immorality. Of course, Shammai would have agreed that divorce could also happen on the basis of Exodus 21, when the vow for provision was broken or when the vow for love was broken. But when it came to interpreting Deuteronomy 24, Shammai said, and any cause divorce is wrong. In Jesus' day, this caused a big debate between the rabbis who followed Hillel and the rabbis who followed Shammai. And everybody wanted to know exactly where every rabbi stood on this subject. It's like the way in our day, we ask politicians, where do you stand on abortion? Or where do you stand on universal health care? They would always ask them, where do you stand on this issue, this Hillel-Shammai split? And this brings us to Jesus, Matthew 19, verse 3. Some Pharisees came to Jesus to test him or trap him. They asked him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause? Now, in my opinion, they're not asking what the Christian church has largely understood this question to be. They're not asking, Rabbi, is divorce always against the law? That was never debated in that day. Divorce was in Moses' law. No rabbi would have ever asked, is it lawful for us to follow Moses' law? It was in the law. What they're asking is, Jesus, how do you interpret Deuteronomy 24? Do you agree with Hillel or Shammai? They're not really even interested in Jesus' answer. The text says they came to test or trap him. Little background, how would this possibly trap him? Because the ruler in Galilee at that time was a man named Herod Antipas. Herod had been married to a princess, the daughter of the king of Nabatea, but while he was married, he fell in love with another woman, Herodias. Unfortunately, Herodias was also married to his brother, Herod Philip. So Herod Antipas divorced his wife, I guess he got an any cause divorce, and talked Herodias into divorcing his brother so he could marry her, which would have made things very awkward at Thanksgiving dinner, don't you think? But they didn't celebrate Thanksgiving. What a problem. John the Baptist heard about this and confronted Herod about it. And he said, Mark 6, verse 18, it is not lawful for you to have Herodias as your wife. Why is it unlawful? Because he would have gotten an any cause divorce to get her, and she would have gotten an any cause divorce to join him. Does anyone here remember what happened to John the Baptist for saying that? He lost his head. So this is a loaded question. The Pharisees are coming to Jesus to test him and trap him. And they ask him, which one? Which way do you go? So he goes back to the very beginning of Torah, Matthew 19, verse 4 and 5. And he says, haven't you read that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. By the way, in Genesis, it just says, and they shall become one flesh. So Jesus adds the two here. And when he adds the two, he's emphasizing that polygamy is not God's plan either. The two shall become one. God's purpose for marriage, a husband and wife, make a permanent, intimate commitment. The Pharisees say, Matthew 19, verse 7, they refer to Deuteronomy 24. Why then did Moses command that the man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? And then the next couple of verses, verse 8 and 9, Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you, anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. Jesus is saying that Herod was wrong, that Hillel was wrong, that if you do the any cause deal, you're wrong. If you do that and get remarried, which have been the expectation in that culture, that's adultery. You're breaking the marriage covenant. Because the only grounds Jesus mentions here is sexual immorality. Some people have thought that the New Testament position is that's the only biblical grounds for divorce, or for divorce and remarriage, sexual immorality. And that's led to anguish and heartbreak and confusion and, I think, tragedy. I've heard this kind of thing over and over. You mean that if my husband beats me, beats our children, is addicted to drugs and alcohol, steals money, tries to kill me, I have to stay married to him? People thought this is what it means to be biblical on this issue. And they throw compassion and love out the window. They think it's all about legality. There was a woman in this church about 20 years ago who was so desperate to divorce her husband biblically. This is true. She told me. She hired a prostitute to try to seduce him so she could divorce him biblically. I had a friend in another church about a dozen years before that who was so desperate to get rid of his wife while still maintaining the church's and his parents' approval that he drugged her and set fire to their house. Fortunately, neither of these plans worked. But you hear heart-wrenching stories every day. There are women saying, "You mean he can threaten to kill me, threaten to kill my child, and I can't divorce him?" That is not what Jesus is saying. In Matthew 19 and elsewhere, Jesus is not talking about the whole Jewish framework of marriage and divorce that was a part of his world as rabbi. He's not discussing what happens when the vows of Exodus 21, provision and love, are broken. He's addressing a misinterpretation of Deuteronomy 24 and the Hillel-Shammai debate. So, Jesus, what is your interpretation of Deuteronomy 24:1? Jesus' response was basically, "I'm a Shammai guy. I'm against any cause divorce." And he would have shared the understanding that biblically, where the vows of marriage, Deuteronomy 24:1 and Exodus, are broken, and where there's hard-heartedness, then divorce may well be the only option. I want to be very direct here for a moment. If you're in an abusive situation, or someone you know and love is in an abusive situation, if you or your children are in danger, get out. Get safe. Too often the church has not spoken clearly on this. Wise Christian counseling can help. Being in a Christian community is important. Do not think that obedience to God means remaining in a situation where you or your children's lives are in danger. That's not biblical. And it's not loving, it's not merciful, it's not wise, and it's not what Jesus was teaching. So get safe. We can see another indicator that the first century church understood that this was Jesus' teaching in Paul's writing to the church in Corinth. You need to know that marriage as an institution in the Roman world was not in great shape. The emperor, Caesar Augustus, had seen that Roman men were avoiding marriage so they could engage in multiple relationships, sexual relationships, and affairs. Hard to believe men would do something like that in his day. But they were avoiding marriage. They didn't want to make a commitment. They were keeping their options open, and they were playing the field. Caesar was so concerned by the lack of legal sons being born into Roman households that he actually established a law in 18 BC making it compulsory for Roman citizens to get married. And if you got divorced, within 18 months you had to be remarried under Roman law. Partly because of this, divorce was very easy in Rome. By Roman law, to get a divorce, you just walked out the door. That was all there was to it. But you had to get remarried within 18 months. There's an old country western song titled, "I Bought the Shoes That Are Walking Out on Me." I thought that was kind of funny, but apparently I'm the only one. That's how the divorce went in ancient Rome. It was not good. The world that the early church faced was full of wide-scale cohabitation, sexual immorality, compulsory marriage laws, and divorce as easy as walking out the door. Marriage was in trouble. Paul writes to the little church at Corinth and says, "Don't do that. Don't live like that. Honor your marriage vows. Don't seek down to the Roman bar. Live up to God's standard. Even if you've married an unbeliever and you become a Christian, continue to seek to honor your promise to that person, your vow to that person." Now, there's further teaching. He says, but, 1 Corinthians 7, verse 15, "But if you're married to an unbeliever and the unbeliever abandons you, leaves, let him do so. A believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances." In other words, if your spouse abandons you, the marriage is over, and you're free to remarry. A little later, he qualifies that, I think, in the Lord, to another believer. And Paul would not understand himself to be amending Jesus. He's not tacking on additional grounds for divorce. He's not adding abandonment as another grounds for divorce in addition to adultery, as he didn't have to. He would have understood that he and Jesus were in agreement with the framework that they grew up in and were teaching out of, that the teaching of the Old Testament was that marriage was a vow to be faithful, a vow to provide, and a vow to love. Sexual faithfulness includes not having an affair with another woman, but it also includes not having a life of chronic indulgence in pornography or lust or something similar. It's a vow, and God's intent is that it's to last forever. Now, sometimes vows are broken. That does not mean that divorce is okay, even if vows are broken. Sometimes in churches, people have been legalistic about this, and they've said, you know, my spouse has been unfaithful to me one time, and they've come and they've repented, they asked me to forgive them, but still, I have grounds for divorce, and I'm going to pursue a divorce. Well, that's not necessarily the right thing to do. The key is hard-heartedness. Is that a merciful and loving thing to do? Remember, the religious leader said, why did Moses command us to get divorced if we find something indecent in our wife? And Jesus answered, no, Moses did not command you to get divorced. He permitted you to get divorced. And there's a big difference. He permitted you to do that because of hard-heartedness. The idea here is that even if a marriage vow is broken, if the spouse is repentant, if they're soft-hearted, if they're willing to reconcile, then seek to rebuild the marriage. But if the spouse refuses to repent, if they're repeatedly engaged in infidelity, if there's a stubborn, hard-hearted, defiant decision to reject reconciliation and reject intimacy and reject God, reject his ways, reject rebuilding, then it well may be that divorce is the only option. When there's the breaking of vows and a chronic, hard-hearted spirit, it is the only option. Compassion and love are always at the heart of this issue, which leads us to the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus puts things a little differently in the Sermon on the Mount, which he does on many topics in the Sermon on the Mount. I'm going to read this first from the New Revised Standard Version. Matthew 5, 31, 32. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that anyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of unchastity, causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. And then the NIV, as you see there, go ahead and put it back up. In the NIV it says, the new one, it has been said anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. Again, quoting Deuteronomy 24, verse 1. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality makes her the victim of adultery. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So the NIV is basically commenting there because makes her a victim of is not in the Greek. And I don't think it should do this. but it just added that, kind of commenting on the text. I think it says what it says, which is makes her an adulteress. Causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. How is it possible to cause someone else to commit adultery? Well, you have to understand what the word adultery means. It's not the same thing as being sexually unfaithful. It's not the same thing as engaging in sex with another person. That's one form of adultery. That breaks the vows. But adultery is breaking the promise. And the thing is that Jesus is pointing out that to divorce someone that hasn't been sexually unfaithful to you, thereby breaking the vows, to divorce someone is to deprive them of the ability to keep their vow to you. They made a promise that they would love, honor, and cherish you in sickness and in health and in adversity and in prosperity, that they would forsake all others and that they would keep themselves for you only. As long as you live. And that promise is the second most important promise they've ever made to anybody. And it's part of their identity, part of who they are. And when you divorce them, they can't keep that promise. You're taking away that commitment. You're taking away that vow. And that's precious. That vow is precious. It's sacred. And so whoever divorces his wife, except for unchastity, causes her to become an adulteress. It's an unmerciful thing to do. And it's kind of similar to what he says a little bit earlier in the Sermon on the Mount when he says, if you go to worship, you take your gift to the altar, and you remember that someone has something against you, then go reconcile with that person. Not that you have something against them. You don't necessarily have anything against them. There's nothing wrong in your heart. You're coming to celebrate your relationship with God. But it's unmerciful of you to celebrate your relationship with God when someone others, this brother or sister of yours, is in jeopardy because they're holding a grudge against you. Jesus has a way of doing that a lot in the Sermon on the Mount. So, as I said, there's so much more that could be said and that I'd like to say, but we only have one sermon here this morning to cover this, and we'll get back to this on some other places. A lot more could be said. But that is a brief overview of the teaching of Jesus in the Scriptures on the issue of divorce and remarriage. Now I want to address some related issues, because we've been through a lot of information, but this is not an abstract subject. Everybody has been or will be touched by divorce in some way or another. Some of you here have had your heart broken by it. Some of you have been beat up by it and are wondering, is there any life after divorce? And I want to tell you there is. I want to tell you about one more divorce in the Bible and about what happened on the other side. The most striking picture that the prophets used to describe God's relationship to Israel was that it was a marriage. God made a covenant, a promise to Israel because he loved her, and they took a vow in return. And God promised that he would provide for her, care for her, and love her, and she was to love him in return, but God's people were unfaithful to him. And if you go through the Old Testament, often most powerfully, idolatry is compared to, is expressed as a form of adultery, unfaithfulness. And it leads to one of the most amazing and really kind of heart-wrenching statements in all of Scripture. It's God speaking, Jeremiah 3, verse 8. I gave faithless Israel her certificate of divorce and sent her away because of all her adulteries. Understand what that's saying? He's obviously referring to God allowing the Babylonians or causing the Babylonians to destroy Jerusalem and carry his people off into captivity. I gave her a certificate of divorce and sent her away. In the book of Malachi, God says, I hate divorce. Malachi 2, verse 16. A lot of people in churches know that statement. You want to know why God hates divorce? He's been through it. If you don't know the anguish in God's heart, then you need to think about it. This is not a legal issue that we're talking about this morning. This is a hard issue in every case. God says, I've been through all the humiliation of being rejected. God says, I know all about the pain of betrayal. God says, I know all about the anguish of broken vows from hard-hearted people. The prophets of Israel say that God is a divorcee. So God invented the first divorce recovery program at a place called Calvary. And the price for the course was one blood-stained cross. Jesus paid that price for all of us, for you and for me. And God was the first one to go through it. Still in session for anyone who wants to come. In that day, declares the Lord, Hosea 2, verse 19, I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. There's love and compassion at the cross for hard-hearted vow breakers like you and me. And when it comes to this divorce, we've all been on the wrong side of it. We've all been unfaithful to God. And that's why any church that divides people up into superior non-divorced first-class Christians and inferior, beat-up, divorced second-class Christians is theologically errant and spiritually destructive. Notice Dan Blanchard had a post on Facebook this past week. Maybe some of you saw that. His post was the top five truths about divorce that you probably won't hear in church. Five was divorce doesn't end relationships, it just changes them. Four was, other than God himself, no one hates divorce more than divorced people do. Three, divorced believers must not be treated as second-class citizens in the kingdom or outsiders of it. Two, there is an unforgivable sin. Divorce is not it. One, it is not accurate to say or to teach that all divorce is sin, but it is accurate that all divorce is caused by sin. Many of you know Dan or been counseled by Dan. I believe he's a wise man. And on the most important spiritual level, every one of us has been unfaithful. We're all divorcees. We all need the cross. And that's what we want to be as a church. And by the way, marriages need this Jesus. If you don't know, you can turn your life over to him. You can come to the cross. You can go through the divorce recovery program and come out the other side and be betrothed to God. You can do that today. Baptism and marriage have a lot in common. If you're thinking about getting married to someone and you know Jesus and you made a commitment to him and that other person in your life does not know Jesus, I want to warn you, encourage and plead with you. I want to say it as strongly as I possibly can. Do not get married to someone who does not share that ultimate faith commitment. Don't do it. And if you're already in a marriage and you're struggling and you can feel your heart getting hard, if there's any way we can help, if we can serve, we'd love to do that. Call me or one of the other ministers. Talk to one of our elders. Attend the class on Sunday nights for couples. And we have licensed professional counselors, Christian counselors ready to help. Micah and Aaron. All of the elders and ministers and counselors' contact info is on the back of your order of worship. You've got email addresses and phone numbers there. Maybe you've been through a divorce. Maybe you fought desperately to avoid it. Maybe you shoulder a fair amount of responsibility and guilt. You can get healing from God. You can know grace and forgiveness. You don't have to be stuck in anger or guilt. What God would be saying to us is, if you let me, I'd love to heal your heart right now. There is no limit to God's forgiveness and love and acceptance. It's available for you. And there's no limit to our willingness as a church to embrace and accept and love people no matter what they've done. Because we follow Jesus Christ, and that's what he does.